I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, refiners. If you're here for more of this ride, I probably don't need to tell you, but I will anyway. You're listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. This is the third and final installment of our intense deep dive into the 1985 movie, Brazil. This is what I'm calling Severed Origins, a look at those things that inspired the creation of Severance. It's a great way to see where Severance came from. It's also a great way to kill some time until the strikes are settled and we can all get back to our regular assignments on the Severed floor. I'm your host, Alan S. Okay, refiners, settle in with a fresh cup of coffee and open the file called Brazil. It's time to get back into it. No recap, but as usual, huge spoilers for Terry Gilliam's 1985 movie, Brazil. If you've somehow found this installment first, you definitely need to go back and find parts 1 and 2 of the Severed podcast covering Brazil. Last we'd left our intrepid government drone, Sam Lowry, he'd managed to jump on the biggest street legal semi in the world and get in the cab with Jill Layton. She's the woman who lived above Archibald Buttle and happens to look like the girl from Sam's fantasies. This is an important distinction to keep in your head as we go through these next scenes. Sam thinks he knows this woman. He thinks he's in love with this woman. Jill does not know Sam as anything more than the government functionary who delivered a check to Mrs. Buttle and who just claimed to have arrested her in the lobby of information retrieval. She does not like this man, not for any personal reason, but because of what he represents in the government. Sam tries to reason with her, telling her how much trouble she's in.
You are in terrible danger. You're an embarrassment. Please, please drive. Trust me, trust me. Drive and I'll explain everything.
This is a pretty big deal for Sam. He may be helping a terrorist by giving her this information. It doesn't have much of an effect on Jill. She just wants him, well...
Get out of my cab.
After a heated argument which ends with Sam threatening to blast Jill's effing head off, she does go ahead and drive. The guards who'd been taking an interest are no longer a problem. Sam, relieved for the moment, finally introduces himself.
Hello, my name's Lowry. Sam Lowry.
Sam is breathless and giddy. He apologizes for touching her, then goes into a pretty cringy explanation about his motivations for forcing his way into her cab.
I know it's going to sound incredible, but I've been dreaming about you. No, not like that. I mean, I love you. I mean, in my dreams, I love you.
Sam is charming and a bit disarming. He backs up against the passenger door to give her a better look. Jill seems to soften. She laughs.
You probably think I'm bonkers, right? Mad, raving.
No, I think you're very attractive.
She suddenly decides that yes, he is exactly the kind of guy she's looking for. Sam can't believe it.
I just don't deserve such terrific luck.
He doesn't know how right he is. Jill pushes a button which opens the passenger side door. She then turns in her seat and pushes Sam out the door with the force of both boots. As soon as Sam is out the door, gone, Jill has a cigarette in her mouth. She looks tough and uncaring, staring straight ahead with dead eyes. I mentioned at the end of our last session we might already be in Sam's head at this point in the movie. This sequence seems to support the "this is already the fantasy" theory. Sam is outside of this massive truck. Some reviewers have compared Sam's antics to the Indiana Jones scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark. In Indy's case, his movements are spectacular, but a bit more believable. Sam's antics are Harold Lloyd-level slapstick. He is all over the outside of the commander. At one point, after watching him holding on with both hands, he somehow manages to write a note that says, "Trust me." He then holds it up in the window. The same words, you remember, he was saying to Jack Lint during their meeting in Jack's office. We will hit a scene where the bulk of reviewers believe Sam slips into his delusion. I tend to think it's already happening. Sam is on top of the truck, backwards and upside down at full speed. He's able to write, "I love you," in the mud on the Scammel's windshield. Jill couldn't care less. When she sees Sam through the back window, she floors it and cuts the wheel. She is actively trying to throw him off. Sam is able to somehow climb up the side. He should have fallen off multiple times. Finally, Jill slams on the brakes and Sam is thrown over the front of the commander's huge hood. After a long pause, Sam peeks up over the front edge of the hood. Jill runs around to the front of the truck, now suddenly worried she may have actually hurt him. Sam is in a full split on the front grill.
You don't trust me, do you?
Sam seems to have melted Jill's heart. Didn't that seem a bit too easy? Eh, maybe. Here comes a weirdly disoriented cut. We see a figure in a heavy black hazmat suit open a door and wave. As they are waving, the building they are standing in lifts up into the air. Aside from the person in the hazmat suit, the house looks very idyllic, with a white picket fence and bushes out front. As the house lifts up, the background is revealed. It's an enormous gasworks. Yellow and orange flames are belching out of dense piping. It's a very industrial-looking scene. A poster with the Central Services ducks on it can be seen to the side. It says, "Power today, pleasure tomorrow." The house keeps rising up through industrial flames and belching smoke past a huge array of piping. The house is being lowered onto a flatbed trailer as the Scammel commander is being backed up to the hitch. There's a surreal shot right here. Don't miss the guys in hazmat suits playing volleyball. They've got two full teams all decked out in those eerie black hooded suits.
Oh my God, we shouldn't have come here!
No, they probably shouldn't, but Jill says she's got a job to do. She has to haul this house somewhere. Sam gets out of the passenger side as Jill gets out of the driver's side. They're walking along the trailer, talking under the house, which is being lowered onto it. Don't miss the poster on the far side. It's visible under the edge of the house for less than a second. It says, 3 consecutive hours without a time loss accident. This might be a dangerous place to work. I'm not sure why this is a place that would have a house that needs to be hauled around, but whatever. Sam is trying to talk Jill into taking the truck and making a run for it. She says they couldn't go far enough. Besides, she's got a job to do, and she doesn't want to lose her job. Sam crosses to her under the front hitch. Wow, is that truck huge. Another poster is visible. Mind that parcel. Eagle eyes can save a life. Sam loses track of Jill. Somehow, she's managed to get pretty far up on one of the catwalks. What exactly is this place? Gasworks? A smelting plant? It's dangerous, it's loud, it belches out fire everywhere, and seems to be pretty lax with the security. A truck driver is able to climb up one of the catwalks without anyone seeming to care. Jill climbs even higher. Sam decides to follow her. Somehow, Sam manages to get above Jill. Peering down through a railing, Sam can see she's talking to another figure in a hazmat suit. This worker hands her a package. It's wrapped in brown paper and twine. Sam looks suspicious. There's a bit of a time jump here. After Jill picks up the box from the gas plant, there are some shortened cuts in the 132-minute edit while Sam is watching her through the factory. Little snips happen until right before they cut back to the truck heading down the road between rows of billboards. In this future world, billboards, which used to be accused of blocking the scenery, are now actively being used to hide the countryside from the driver's view. The surrounding landscape is an ugly, barren wasteland. Billboards of the future line the highway side by side, so no one on the road can see what's happening on the other side. We do go flying right by the billboards, but I was able to catch one of them. Soft weave toilet tissue. It's mountain smooth, whatever that means. As the commander is roaring along the billboard-lined highway, Sam is concerned about the package Jill picked up.
What's in the parcel?
He just got her to halfway trust him. Now he's throwing shade at her. She tells him it's a Christmas present. Sam thinks it's awfully heavy.
You don't trust me? Open it.
Sam says, no, it's fine.
I'd spoil the wrapping.
If she's going to trust him, he'd better be able to trust her. Sam is starting to think this might be a terrorist bomb. If it is, Jill seems to be pretty casual about having it in the cab of the bouncing truck. We're coming to a major roadblock. This is an established checkpoint with huge metal arms blocking the road. There's a bit of a time jump here as they arrive at the roadblock. New cuts shorten this sequence. As we get into the chase scene through the city, some of the shots here have been changed for the shorter edit, but it doesn't seem like they've really cut anything down during the chase scene. As they approach the checkpoint, Jill begins to question Sam about his work.
Doesn't it bother you, the sort of things you do in information retrieval?
None of the government is great, but what happens in information retrieval is known to be particularly heinous. IR is the torture arm of the ministry, and they have the reputation for being brutal. Sam immediately adopts the party line when it comes to IR.
Suppose you'd rather have terrorists.
Oh, come on. Jill's not buying it.
How many terrorists have you met, Sam? Actual terrorists.
Sam hums and haws a bit over this, then finally admits...
Well, it's only my first day.
So maybe he's not the big bad terrorist hunter he'd want us to believe. Jill has a good laugh over this. Sam realizes how he sounds and laughs along with her. They are almost to the very imposing checkpoint.
Stay calm.
Sam starts freaking. He tells her to keep going.
Don't slow down. Don't slow down.
Jill is confident she can get them through this without a confrontation. Sam reaches over with his foot and pushes down on the Scammel's accelerator.
Go, go, go!
Okay, so maybe Sam didn't have the only F-bomb in the movie. As the truck is approaching the gate, a billboard is visible for Neptune Filter Cigarettes, the sea spray-flavored cigarette. The giant commander rams through the swing arms without even slowing down.
We did it! We did it! We broke right through the... We did it!
Another couple of billboard glimpses, a pine-scented toilet tissue, different from Mountain Smooth that we saw a minute ago, and a picture of a bottle that looks like it might be an old 7-Up bottle. Sirens can be heard whining behind them. The very odd-looking police vehicles are in pursuit. These things look like a rolling deep freeze with a headlight. We then get an extended chase scene through the city. The hallways appear to be in the Abraxas apartment complex. A couple of items to note during the chase. The cops have machine gun turrets mounted on their cars. Oh, and refiners, make sure to check the guys in the police cars. They have clear faceplates that are backlit. One cop has his face lighted red, the other green. Yep, severance chip colors. As they're racing through the very tight city streets, Sam has an idea.
What if we lose a house, yeah? We lose
a
house.
Don't touch anything!
I did not know Big Rigs had a lever that would allow the driver to jettison cargo and only cargo. This is not a lever to disconnect the trailer. It releases the cargo sitting on the trailer. As Jill goes careening around a corner, the house slides off the trailer. It stays upright and spins sideways to completely block the street. When the police vehicles come whipping around the corner, they are face to face with a house sitting where a street should be. As they go shooting through the newly positioned house, the police vehicles explode. Sam is celebrating like a little kid until he looks through the commander's back window. One of the cops, now in flames, is walking through the burning remains of the house and vehicles. It's all fun and games until somebody winds up engulfed in flames. Cut to a gaudy street scene on level 43. There's a neon green lighted tree. What looks like a Salvation Army band is passing by, but it's not the Salvation Army because we're in Gilliam World. The banner they're carrying reads, Consumers for Christ. They're playing a rousing rendition of Joy to the World. This cut further adds to the idea we are in Sam's head. We don't get any connective tissue. How did they get out of the truck and away from the security and the police who were chasing them? They just blew up multiple police vehicles while recklessly driving a monster truck through the middle of town. It seems improbable they could have escaped and be walking around in public like this now. There's a scene of Santa talking to little ones. We hear one of the kids' Christmas wishes is to have a credit card. Armed stormtroopers mill amongst the shoppers. We're entering a shop filled with scantily clad female mannequins. For some reason, Jill's mission with the Christmas gift has brought her here. Older ladies, Ida's peers, are perusing through rather risque lingerie. Sam wants to know why they've come here. Sam is freaked while Jill is just mad. Sam wants to go back to his flat, anything but being out here in public. Even after the bit of thawing earlier, it's obvious he and Jill are still not trusting each other.
Okay. You don't trust me, I don't trust you. What's in that parcel?
Sam and Jill start to fight over the package just as an even more heavily bandaged Alma Terrain rolls up in her wheelchair. She's accompanied, as always, by daughter Shirley. Sam and Jill happen to be fighting by a mirror, which sets up a fun visual gag. Jill's arm is around Sam's neck, but we can't see her. Sam's head is jammed up against the mirror. As he's trying to get free, it looks like he's wrestling with himself. Sam eventually pulls Jill's arm off his neck, and she goes flying. Mrs. Terrain is having even more problems with her procedure.
My complication had a little complication.
One of her hands is now completely bandaged, and there's even a strip of bandage strung across her nose. She looks bad. Although the endlessly optimistic Dr. Chapman says she'll soon be up and springing about.
Like a young gazelle.
She then asks if Sam is buying something for his mother. Ugh. Mrs. T says she and Shirley do come here regularly.
We love romantic lingerie.
Sam looks a bit nauseous at this thought. Shirley also cringes. Mrs. Terrain then holds up a scandalously scanty bit of lace that must be some kind of underwear.
Picture me in these.
No, thank you. As Sam is trying not to think of her in those, one of the biggest bomb blasts we've seen yet rips through the store. Sam immediately leaves Mrs. Terrain and Shirley to go find Jill. She was over in the part of the store where the most destruction has occurred. Bloody hands and arms are reaching for Sam's pant leg, much like the brick arms of Kurtzman that grabbed him in his fantasy. Sam sees Jill's boot protruding from under a pile of rubble. These search scenes have been cut down by about 20 seconds in the 132-minute edit. Jill is shaken up and dirty, but otherwise okay. After Jill says she's all right, Sam punches her in the shoulder.
But you don't deserve to be.
He's sure the parcel they retrieved from the gasworks was responsible for this blast. Sam shouting it was a bomb. He should have opened it. As he's going on and on about the destruction, Jill quietly reaches over in the debris and retrieves the parcel she'd been carrying. Oops, okay, so maybe she wasn't involved in the bombing. But if it's not a bomb, what's in the box? Sam pulls a smaller box out of the brown paper. It's one of those desktop decision makers, just like the ones he's both been given and re-gifted in the past few days. She must have a dozen of them in the parcel.
Pride. Artificial monkeys like you.
Jill is surly, but not a terrorist. She was planning to use these gifts in her ongoing campaign to gain justice for Mr. Buttle. Sam and Jill start to help the injured stormtroopers arrive. Their bedside manner is not the best. Jill's helping an older woman who's covered in blood. One of the stormtroopers roughly grabs the woman.
Don't touch her, Jake. She's hard.
The stormtrooper pushes Jill to the floor. This situation is getting ugly. At the point where Sam shouts to the stormtroopers to leave Jill alone, we get a glimpse of the samurai in both cuts. In the longer 142-minute cut, as soon as Sam lifts one of the mannequin arms to fight, he's struck in the back by the butt of a stormtrooper gun. We cut to a paddy wagon where he's being taken in for questioning. In the longer version, remember, we've already seen the complete samurai battle. In the 132-minute version, this is where we get the final victory over the samurai battle scene. We cut to Hero Sam and the continuation of the fight. Sam is turning the samurai's own weapons against him. He's able to pierce the samurai's protection multiple times. Each time Sam breaches the samurai's armor, bright red jets of flame shoot out. I love that the representation of the establishment, the fill-in for the government, is a being made of what appears to be natural gas. After the samurai has been vanquished, a curious Sam pulls off the samurai's mask. He reveals his own face, eyes fixed and staring. As much as Sam wants to be the hero, he realizes he's also part of the problem. He may not be high-ranking, but he is still a cog that allows the government machine to keep running. The shock of seeing his face snaps Sam back to the present. We get a glimpse of him standing in the lingerie store just before the stormtrooper knocks him unconscious with the butt of a rifle. This is where the two versions catch back up to each other. Cut to the interior of the paddy wagon. A siren is wailing as we pan over the group of hooded detainees being hauled in for questioning. Each person is clamped around the neck and suspended for transport. There's a tilt down to the floor. Sam is laying there. He's not in a straitjacket. If you're keeping track of the edit at this point, we are still only about 5 minutes ahead on the shorter version. Adding the samurai battle back in ate up some of the gains he'd made with previous cuts. Two helmeted guards are seated amidst the load of detainees. They are being played by Don Henderson and Howard Lewis. We drop into the conversation as one of them is complaining about the itchy helmets they have to wear. The sweaty conditions aren't great either. One of the guards asks, who's he in regards to Sam?
Oh, I don't know. Somebody from information retrieval.
There's a bit of joking about how those types are often found hanging around lingerie shops. Sam comes to and he's frantic. He starts to open the face holes on the straitjackets, trying to figure out which hanging prisoner is Jill. The guards calmly tell him to stop it. That's government property. Sam ignores them and continues to search. He describes her to the guards. They are not interested in helping out. It's not their concern. As Sam keeps searching, one of the guards calmly whacks him in the head and knocks him unconscious.
No! Oh.
Sorry about that, sir.
Regulations.
The paddy wagon roars on through the streets. Cut to a close-up of Mr. Warren from Expediting. He's right in Sam's face, and he is not happy. Expediting is an executive branch. There needs to be some decorum. Sam's issue with the Messerschmitt has blown up way out of proportion.
Damn it, Lowry! That convoy of personnel carriers is still not accounted for. I thought I told you to deal with it. And what the hell is this mess?
It's a convoy now? He really should have taken care of it when it first came up. Sam's half desk is crammed with folders. Warren is flipping through them, appalled at the topics.
Queries from security. Searches from central banking about a check. Clarification notices from accounting concerning unreturned receipts.
Sam has been blinded by love and not paying attention to the paperwork. When you list all the things he's done in the past few days without context, they do look pretty bad. Harvey Lime is perched over Warren's right shoulder looking as smug as can be. Warren is fuming. Sam tries to offer an explanation, but he's told to shut up.
Shut up! I don't know what's going on here. Don't think you can intimidate us with your friends and relatives in high places. Now shape up!
With that, he turns on his heel and strides out of Sam's office. His coterie of sycophants is close behind. Lime hangs back. Sam says he needs to use his computer.
Sorry, a bit busy at the moment.
Lime retreats to his office and locks the door. An aggressive Sam chases him but can't get in.
Shit.
Cut to the wooden desk we saw in Jack Lint's office. Don't miss the detail at the cut. There are three different pictures of what appears to be the same little girl sitting in three different frames on Jack's desk. The triplets. These shots are actually Terry Gilliam's daughter Amy in three different poses. This cut is also picking up a little more time. In the longer version, there's a scene where Sam gets on the elevator with Jack, then goes to his office. The 132-minute edit dispenses with the elevator ride and cuts right into Jack's office. There's a close-up of Jack closing his briefcase. It's filled with what might be old-timey-looking tools of torture. On top of the torture devices are a couple of children's books. Sam is frustrated. He tells Jack, of course he can search to see if Jill's been arrested. Jack is distracted. He's getting ready to leave. Not only does he pack the briefcase, he also puts a plate in a tactical vest that appears to be bulletproof. When you do what Jack does for a profession, you're bound to make some enemies. Sam is pleading on behalf of Jill. He says she's innocent.
Tell that to the wives of the security men she blew up this afternoon.
Oh. We know she didn't blow anybody up, but that's how it looked. It's the perfect frame-up. It's even quite possibly it was the government that blew up the department store as a way to implicate Jill. Jack doesn't want anything to do with Sam, Jill, or the whole affair. He says it's become far too complicated. He's seeing a conspiracy involving Jill and Harry Tuttle. Tuttle's also been targeted for some framing.
Tuttle has wrecked an entire flat and sabotaged adjacent central services.
Jack says it happened in Sam's block. I'm thinking it happened in Sam's flat, and it wasn't Tuttle who messed things up. Sam tries to convince Jack this whole line of thinking is foolish.
But Jack, you don't really think Tuttle and the girl are in league, do you?
Jack doesn't want to form an opinion. He says it's his job to reveal the connections, whatever they may be. He also has an interesting theory for what we know was a dead bug in the works.
This whole Bumble Tuttle confusion was obviously planned from the inside.
Sure, from Jack's paranoid perspective, it may seem that way, but we know it was an entirely unforeseeable accident. Sam follows Jack off the elevator, still pleading. Jack turns and says, he and Sam have always been close, right? Sam interprets this as a positive.
Yes, Jack?
Until this all blows over, just stay away from me.
Wow, Sam is left high and dry with no help from his old friend. Sam returns to his office where he throws a fit. He's tossing folders everywhere when a tube arrives. Sam jams it back up the send side. Another arrives. Sam starts jamming random papers in the tubes and sending them back. As more and more tubes arrive, Sam rips a flexible duct off the wall. He uses it to connect the in tube to the out tube. Pressure builds up until an explosion can be heard somewhere in the ceiling. I feel like this scene is revealing more of Sam's psychosis. He's going slowly crazy, and I believe he's becoming an unreliable narrator. There's no way those solid transport tubes could make the bend in the flexible hose. The flexible hose could never stay in position to build up that much pressure. This is all a fantasy. It's wishful thinking on Sam's part. When Sam goes into the hall after the explosion, loose sheets of paper are fluttering everywhere. All the paper transferred through the hydraulic system is in those sealed tubes. There's no loose paper anywhere in the system, but Sam is seeing it floating to the ground. Is it really, or are we a witness to Sam's delusions? Even after blowing up the system, Sam is somehow able to leave the ministry at the end of the day. He returns to his flat, but his key won't work. Sam pushes through the door with his shoulder. The following scenes with Spore and Dowser are cut down slightly for the U.S. edit, saving about 20 seconds. We can see Sam's breath when he enters, and icicles are visible. Sam finds Spore calmly reading a digest-sized Us magazine in the midst of the frozen chaos of the apartment.
What's happening? What's happening?
Spore is now dressed in a see-through hazmat suit with attached ducts. The ducts seem to be providing some heat and oxygen to the suits. Dowser is in the background wearing a similar suit. Spore tells Sam there are big problems with the thermostat.
And then, Sam?
Yeah, we got that part. The phone bleats. When Sam tries to answer it, Spore grabs it away and drops a bombshell.
But, as you don't live here anymore.
What?
Spore could not be happier, as he explains.
You know what this is? This is an H2206 authorizing the compulsory, temporary requisitioning of this flat for unnecessary repairs.
Prepare!
Dowser grabs Sam by the shoulders. As he's giving him the bum's rush out the door, Spore hands over Sam's receipt.
Sorry, but I'm a bit of a stickler for paperwork.
Out on the balcony, Sam is beating on the door, wanting to be let back in when he hears... It's Harry Tuttle. He's got one of his suction handles on a panel outside Sam's apartment. He's also got his trusty Yankee screwdriver at the ready. Sam is thrilled. Tuttle shushes him as he pulls the panel out of the wall and hands it to Sam. Tuttle has revealed two ducts, one marked sewage, the other marked air conditioning. Again, refiners, we may be more deeply into Sam's perceptions than anything here. No, it's not customary that both air and water would be traveling through the same kinds of ducts. Sewage would go through a pipe. But in Gilliam world, or as I think Sam's world, this kind of switch is entirely possible. Tuttle turns off the flow to both sides. He disconnects the duct marked sewage. A disgusting mess is visible in the opening. He hands it to Sam, who indicates it stinks. The other duct, the AC, disconnects just as easily. It uses the same fitting and connection as the sewage. Harry connects up the sewage to the AC and the AC to the sewage. Tuttle silently hands an item to Sam and points up. It's a periscope. Sam extends it to look through the window of his former flat. Spore and Dowser can be seen moving around in the flat. Tuttle flips the levers controlling flow to each of the ducts he just rerouted. A close-up of the hazmat suits reveals a brown liquid sluicing into the legs of each suit. The sealed suits start filling at their ankles and working its way up. The suits are airtight, so nothing is escaping. Dowser tells Spore to look at his trousers. Sam is getting a little disgusted just watching.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
Spore's suit is filled to the chest. He throws down his clipboard, now panicking over whatever is happening to their suits. Tuttle lights a cigar as Sam continues to watch the carnage. A cut back to the periscope view shows the brown liquid now covering Dowser's face. Spore isn't far behind.
Oh.
Dowser's suit explodes. There's a disgusting splash on the window Sam had been looking through. After both hazmat suits full of raw sewage have exploded, Sam and Harry once again recite the amended billboard we saw at the Shangri-La Apartments. Remember how someone had scratched out happiness and spray-painted the shit as what we were all in together?
Shit! We're all in it together, kid.
There you go. As Sam and Harry are laughing about the fate of the two Central Service operatives, there's movement in the hall. Tuttle pulls his pistol and gets in a defensive stance. The reverse cut reveals Jill coming around the corner of the hallway. She's backlit and walking through a bit of fog. I consider this another indication we're in Sam's head. How would Jill know where he lives? They didn't have time to exchange information at the department store before the bombing and the arrival of the stormtroopers. She's never been to his apartment yet. Here she is, looking tough but cute in her work boots and bomber jacket.
Jill! Jill. Oh, God. Are you all right?
She offers no explanation as to how she got away. Instead, she asks about the mark on Sam's cheek. Just as Sam is leaning in for a kiss, Tuttle clears his throat. We cut over to Harry chomping his cigar, about to zip line away. He gives Sam a waved salute and flies off the balcony. Another lead miniature goes zipping down the apartment complex.
Who was that?
Sam says it's a friend of his, just as he hears sirens in the distance.
We better get out of here quick. Come on.
One of those lurking operatives, like the ones we saw out at the Shangri-La Apartments, was watching Sam's place from the flight of stairs above. We see Sam and Jill walking through the foggy streets and up the dramatic circular stairs that lead to Ida's apartment. Some more time has been cut from this transition. Jill is wandering around Ida's enormous and garish apartment.
Are you sure this is all right?
Sam says his mother's away for Christmas. She's spending it with her plastic surgeons.
The wraps come off tomorrow.
I'm sure Dr. Jaffe is happily snipping and cutting away the holiday with his star patient.
Just me and my little knife. Snip, snip.
It's
marvelous. Slice, slice.
Jill gets in close to Sam. Sam moves in. They really tease this out, but finally, they kiss. The music crash is deafening. Sam's overcoat comes off as they fall to one of Ida's couches. Sam's eyes suddenly fly open. He's got an idea.
Lock the door after me.
What now? Jill was just ready to jump your bones there, Sam. What's the big idea?
Don't answer the phone to anyone.
Sam jumps up, running out the door. He says he knows a way to save Jill. Again, he says,
trust me. I can do it.
Jill is shouting after him. He can't go without her. Well, I guess he can. Jill looks around, spins around, then falls back onto the couch. Sam has returned to the ministry well after hours. The monolithic building has spotlights playing over it. As Sam passes through the lobby, workers are cleaning the floors. Polishers and vacuums with big ducts attached are working all over the large expanse of lobby floor. Sam passes by and climbs the stairs. He approaches Dawson, who's playing with the executive decision maker. Those things are like catnip. Sam wants to be put through to Helpman. Dawson says, of course he can't, because Sam must go through the proper channels.
And you can't tell me what the proper channels are, because that's classified information.
I'm glad to see the ministry's continuing its tradition of recruiting the brightest and best, sir.
Thank you, Dawson.
I do enjoy Dawson. Sam heads down into the basement. He's got an idea. Remember that elevator he happened onto the other day? He heads for it now. Helpman's elevator. This sequence has also been shortened for the 132-minute version. Sam still finds the guards practicing their singing, but he gets to Helpman's elevator a lot faster in the 132-minute edit. At the point where we're looking at Helpman's elevator panel, the 132-minute edit is now a full 6 minutes shorter than the 142 cut. Sam has figured out Helpman's special elevator, the one with letters instead of numbers on the selection panel. We can hear Helpman's voice echoing in Sam's head.
Here I am, J.A., the ghost in the machine.
Sam has realized the ghost in the machine is Helpman's code to activate the elevator. It's his password. Sam types it in exactly the way Helpman had written it in the powder. The elevator responds immediately. The elevator opens on a very posh upper floor. It's got a swinging 60s look to it. A pair of double doors are covered in faux leather with button tufting. The stylish reception desk is empty.
Mr. Helpman.
Wow, Helpman has a very cool office. Hold on a minute, what's this? Helpman also has a picture of Sam's mother framed on his desk. This might be more than a friendship he has with old Jeremiah's widow. As Sam is snooping in Helpman's office, the 132-minute edit is trimmed about 30 seconds from his looking around. Sam continues to snoop in Helpman's office. He finds rows of printers all kicking out information on the populace. He then gets to Helpman's workstation. He logs in and begins to type. The cut back to Ida's apartment happens faster in the shorter edit.
Jill.
The apartment seems empty, at least the front room. Sam finds Jill back in the bedroom. Feeding even more into this idea that we're already in Sam's fantasy, Jill is wearing a long, flowing wig. She's also in Sam's mother's bedroom, which is adorned with yards of sheer, flowing material. It looks just like the vision Sam was having in his hero fantasies. Is it me, or does this seem a little too on the nose for Sam? It would make a lot of sense if this was all happening in his head.
What do you think? Is it me?
Sam is speechless. He's looking at his fantasy. He's standing at the edge of the bed with his mouth hanging open.
You don't exist anymore.
This is what Sam was up to in Helpman's office.
I've killed you.
He went through Jill's file and deleted her. She now shows up with all of the same reports as what they found about Buttle.
Jill Layton is dead.
Jill has been officially eliminated from the roles of the living. Sam produces the photo page from Jill's official file. It shows a large delete stamped at an angle over her head.
Care for a little necrophilia?
Oh, that's a little gross. Sam is not put off by it in the least. He throws off his coat and launches himself onto the bed. We get a down angle looking through the swirl of fabric over the bed. The round swirl closes around them. You can come up with your own interpretations of this image. The whole thing struck me as very Oedipal. Sam is bedding his dream girl in his mother's bed, and she's wearing one of his mother's wigs. If Sam were in therapy, I think this scene might get a couple of raised eyebrows from his therapist. Cut to Sam, the hero, flapping his wings and lifting his dream girl up with him into the clouds. Yes, this is the sex scene, gang. In the 132-minute edit, there's an immediate cut from the fantasy sequence to the ceiling of Ida's bedroom. We've seen this shot before. A circle is being cut out of the ceiling, just like the one they cut in Buttle's apartment. The circle of ceiling comes crashing down in a shower of sparks. A black-suited stormtrooper smashes the window and swings in on a rope. We can see daylight behind him, so Sam and Jill did at least get a night together. A couple of stormtroopers come sliding down the pole. The door to the bedroom is smashed in. Seven or eight heavily armed stormtroopers now surround the bed, guns raised. Sam is trying to explain.
She's dead.
There's a cut to black. Jill screams. Guns go off. Sam screams. Note of this scene. High-caliber automatic weapons were trained on Jill. Then we hear gunshots. This does not bode well for Jill. One of the biggest time jumps between the two versions happens here on Christmas morning. In the 142-minute edit, we see Sam wake up. Instead of immediately being invaded by stormtroopers, we have a couple of minutes of quiet. Sam finds a naked Jill kneeling in the bed. She has a ribbon wrapped around her breasts. She says she's a Christmas present and invites Sam to unwrap her. After he removes the bow, they start to roll around on the bed together. This is when we cut to the shot of the hole being cut in the ceiling. The little bit with the stormtroopers around the bed is the same. Then, after Sam is transferred to the ministry, there's an entire scene where his crimes are read to him before he winds up in Jack's interrogation chair. In the shorter version, we go right from the bed to Sam in the interrogation chair. In the longer edit, we see some of Sam's intake process once he gets to the ministry. They don't just rush you right into the interrogation room. Multiple government representatives list Sam's charges and what might happen to him from here on. He's hanging from the hooded straitjacket in these offices as things are being read to him. They do pile on the charges. This is the payoff to the long-running theme of information retrieval charges being levied against detainees. We heard about them in Helpman's first talk bit in the very first scene with the bug. Now we are hearing just what might be included on one of those information retrieval invoices.
You are charged with the following. Giving aid and comfort to the enemies of society, attempting to conceal a fugitive from justice, passing confidential documents to unauthorized personnel via IR dossier, Gillian Layton.
And, of course, the personnel carrier comes back to bite Sam in the butt.
Destroying government property via an indeterminate number of personnel carriers, taking possession under false pretenses of said personnel carriers.
Now he's accused of taking it without permission and losing it. He's even being charged with misdirecting ministry funds to the widow of a Buttle. That's what you get for being a good guy and going out to hand-deliver a refund check.
Now, either you plead guilty to, say, 7 or 8 of the charges, which is going to help keep costs down within your means, or you can borrow a sum to be negotiated from us at very competitive rates.
More functionaries appear in Sam's field of view. He's looking out the tiny opening on the front of the straitjacket hood with a bewildered expression. Need a loan to pay your fees? No problem. Sam has quoted loan rates for paying off his interrogation bill. While all of these different representatives are talking to him about his options, we can see through these semi-opaque plastic sheet walls. Other prisoners are being moved through other offices, all hanging from their necks in the very scary hooded straitjackets. After Sam hears about his financing options, there is even more cutting. Sam is placed in a padded cell in the 142-minute version. We don't see this at all in the 132-minute cut. In his cell, Sam is visited by Mr. Helpman. Helpman is in his wheelchair, and he's dressed as Santa Claus. Helpman explains he's headed to visit the orphans for Christmas, but decided to stop by and give Sam some advice first.
Sam, information retrieval is expensive. You're running up an enormous bill by not cooperating.
It's here Sam asks about Jill. Helpman tells him she's dead.
I'm afraid she's up stumps and retired to the pavilion, thrown in the towel.
Dead?
Yeah, it's all a bit confusing, but it seems she was killed resisting arrest.
The screams, the gunfire, she was most likely shot right there in Ida's bed. Sam tries to explain that no, he's the one who killed her. He did it in the computer. Helpman then says it appears she somehow died twice. So she really did die the second time. Knowing Jill is dead, really and truly dead, is a crushing blow to Sam. Confirming Jill's death is one of the key things Gilliam cut for the U.S. edit. Not specifically revealing that Jill was dead was Gilliam's one concession to Universal, who didn't want such a dark ending for the film. Gilliam is still going to render Sam insane, but at least American audiences would go home thinking maybe Jill somehow survived and escaped. Without this Helpman scene, we never know Jill's fate for certain in the 132-minute edit. All of this cutting has had the desired effect. By the time the two versions catch back up to each other in Jack's interrogation chair, the 132-minute cut is now a full 9 minutes shorter. The thick canvas hood is pulled off Sam's head. He's revealed to be seated in a chair on a platform in an enormous space. The camera does a dramatic pull back to reveal Sam is sitting in a cavernous bell-shaped room. The sweeping, curved walls are either brick or cinder block. This is one of the most unique shooting spaces we've encountered yet. This is also the scene Terry Gilliam says is the most incredible thing he's ever shot as a director. He talked at length about it in a Directors Guild of America feature story. There is a ton of fascinating stuff to unpack when it comes to this scene. First off, where are they? Well, this is an actual cooling tower from the Croydon Power Station, located in South London. This is the Croydon B coal-fired generating plant, which included 6 of these massive cooling towers. The plant went online in 1950. It had just been decommissioned in 1983. Gilliam got in there shortly after the towers had gone to disuse. The cooling towers were demolished in 1991 to make way for an IKEA store, which opened on the site. This entire area is now the Valley Park Retail and Leisure Complex. 2 of the much smaller chimneys from Croydon B were left standing as a local landmark. They are currently capped by blue and yellow bands, IKEA's corporate colors. The girders were there. The platform was not. Gilliam said they built the platform and the walkway running out to it. If you look at the walkway, you can see 2 tracks running down the middle. These are the dolly tracks for the camera. Since they had to be there, it was decided to leave them as a part of the walkway design. When the hood is pulled off Sam's head, we get a dramatic pull back to reveal the entire space. Gilliam said making this sweep took so long, they had to slow down the shooting speed of the camera. The camera was manually pushed backwards over the entire length of the walkway. Because this move was so big, instead of the usual 24 frames per second, the camera on this sweep back was only shooting at 4 frames per second, 1/6 normal speed. This meant the performers in the scene had to act at 1/6 of their normal speed. Once the film was sped back up to 24 frames per second, the result is the fast and dramatic dolly back we see in the final. Gilliam said the hardest part of getting this move was stopping the rig before it hit the back wall. He says he was ultimately satisfied with the end result. The objective was an audience gasp as the space was revealed. Gilliam said the other real challenge to this shooting space was safety. Depending on the shot, there could be as many as 8 people out on that platform. There were no guardrails, and it was, according to Gilliam, a pretty small spot to work from. The guards are strapping Sam down. What looks like a metal bicycle helmet is pulled in place over his head. One of the guards offers some whispered advice.
Confess quickly. If you hold out too long, you could jeopardize your credit rating.
This is a significantly cut down reference to all those charges and loans we saw Sam get offered in the longer edit. Sam's point of view goes to the tray of information retrieval tools sitting next to him. Gilliam said he loved the weird mix of stuff on this tray. There's a Black & Decker drill, a scalpel, wrenches, a frontal lobotomizer. But then there's also a rubber ball and a pacifier. It looks like one of the triplets he's been playing out here between Daddy's sessions. The larger devices sitting by the chair might look a bit unsettling because they are actual dental tools from the 1800s. They've been tricked up a bit, but the base tools were used by early dentists, and they are pretty frightening looking. A figure enters the space wearing that horrifying mask. He comes strutting up the walkway in a white coat. This is the same baby mask we saw earlier on the trolls in Sam's fantasy. When we first saw it, I said this was the recreation of a mask Gilliam's mother had given him when he was young. In his DGA interview, Terry goes into a little more detail regarding the origins of the mask. This was actually something he found while digging in his parents' garden one day. It was cracked and rotting, which made it even more frightening. He called it an unsettling mixture of a baby doll and a Buddha. The figure in the mask is Jack Lint, Michael Palin's character. He is noticeably nervous, even shaking, as he approaches Sam. He looks back to the door, possibly hoping for an out, Normally, these information retrieval sessions are happening to anonymous citizens. Jack seems hesitant to be so brutal with a friend. Sam realizes the identity of his interrogator.
Jack, I'm innocent. Please, help me.
Jack's hands are shaking as he selects a tool from the tray. Sam says he's frightened. He wants Jack to take off the mask. Jack calls Sam a stupid bastard, but ultimately resigns himself to the fact this is going to be a professional relationship. As Jack is about to begin his questioning, an amazing thing happens. A gunshot rings out, and a hole is blown open in the forehead of the horrible baby mask.
Jack, no, don't! Please, Jack, no!
Jack Lint turns, looks to the sky, and rips off the mask. His forehead is a bloody mess. Jack drops to his knees, calling for Sam, then collapses face down on the platform. Gilliam said they got this shot as a practical by placing a squib in the mask. A squib is a small explosive device with a detonator. They can be used with or without a fake blood packet. When combined with fake blood, squibs make a very believable bullet wound under clothing. Here, having the squib explode inside the mask created both the dramatic bullet hole effect and the mess of blood on Palin's forehead. Gilliam said the biggest concern here was not the danger of the squib blowing up right in front of Michael Palin's eyes. It was the fact they had such a small space to work in, and Palin had to fall down. Thankfully, he didn't fall off the platform. Once Jack has collapsed, spotlights begin to sweep the space. Sam is looking up. We get a reverse shot to one of the most amazing sequences you're likely to see in any movie. Those are actual stuntmen rappelling down into the cooling tower. Gilliam figured this effect would be done with a miniature. His stunt coordinator convinced him they could actually do it for real. A huge crane was already in position outside the cooling tower, holding a huge light. The crane was also used for staging this stunt. As the stuntmen dropped down into this space, they had to hit those spokes emanating from the center. Each of those girders was a mere 8 inches wide. Gilliam said they not only had to hit the narrow girder, they were doing it while wearing very restrictive masks and firing prop rifles. There was no safety for any of this. Gilliam said there's no way a movie could get away with something like that nowadays. He said the stunt guys really wanted to prove this could be done. Gilliam wasn't going to argue with them. He couldn't believe the incredible shots he was getting. He said this entire scene was done in one take and there were no injuries. The point where Jack Lint takes a bullet to the forehead is considered by most reviewers and academics to be the spot where Sam finally cracks. What really happened instead of the gunshot was actually much nastier. Jack began to torture Sam. Sam checked out and withdrew into his own mind. To get him out of the torture, Sam's mind created the bullet to the forehead and the crew of daredevils dropping in to save him. From here on, we're quite certain everything we're seeing is being created in Sam's brain. He never actually leaves the torture chair for the rest of the movie. But in his head, wow, is he busy. The crew of Sam's rescuers is being led by his good buddy, heating engineer and freedom fighter Archibald Harry Tuttle.
You okay?
Tuttle!
Call me Harry.
Harry starts to get Sam out of the chair restraints. Just as he's being freed, chrome-helmeted guards enter and start shooting. Harry's crew takes up positions on the platform to return fire. Sam is still getting freed from the chair. Tuttle's crew easily takes out the guards. Once Sam is free, they head for the door at the end of the platform. In the outer office, the transcription lady is still typing while reading a pulp novel. A quick cut to the printout shows she was transcribing the attack that just happened. I wasn't sure before, but now I'm thinking she is transcribing these sessions in real time instead of listening back to a tape. Gilliam said the information retrieval lobby set was much smaller than it looks. It was only about 120 feet by 80 feet. When shot with the very wide-angle lenses, it winds up looking huge. He was worried about the look of the wide angle. Footage shot with wide lenses can very easily wind up looking like pop music videos or a horror film if you aren't careful. The elevator is studiously descending. Gilliam loved the idea of this very gung-ho group of commandos all fired up with adrenaline after the daring incursion into the torture chamber, now having to stand calmly in an elevator. They exit into the main lobby. A woman in sunglasses and smoking a cigarette is still using one of the big floor polishers with a huge attached duct. She's into her work. She ignores the armed soldiers. Although there are quite a few pyrotechnics in this film, Gilliam claims he's not the kind of director who gets excited about blowing things up. He says he's much more excited by a good idea than he is by destroying set pieces. Although he was drawn in by the idea of a violent video game on Dawson's desk computer. He called it a little joke. He was obsessed with violence, especially on television and in movies and games. He was seeing the beginnings of video games and what they could be, even in the 16-bit world of the early 1980s. He decided to create a violent video game on Dawson's monitor as satire. It's not exactly clear if Dawson is somehow affecting the action in front of him, or if what he's playing is similar in violence and action as to what's happening. It does seem like Dawson detonates the bomb that sends one of the stunt guys flying. Gilliam said this particular flying stunt was accomplished with a small trampoline and good timing on the part of the pyrotechnics crew. No wires, no safety lines, just a talented stunt guy flying through the air. There is another homage to a classic film happening in the midst of this battle. The lone cleaning woman who we noticed at the open of the scene gets shot in the eye. There is a haunting close-up of her face, mouth open in a scream, and a cigarette still clinging to her lower lip. There's a bullet hole surrounded by shattered glass through her left lens. There's blood coating the underside of the lens and dripping down the side of her face. As she screams and throws her head back, she lets go of the cleaning machine she'd been using. It starts down the steps slowly, one at a time, as the chrome-helmeted guards advance behind, shooting on their way down. This scene is lifted directly from a 1925 film called Battleship Potemkin. Gilliam called it a nerdy little film buff joke. He said writing Brazil took so long, by the time he got to the business of shooting it, he needed to entertain himself with some new ideas. This is one of his diversions. The original scene in Potemkin features Cossacks advancing down the Odessa steps. Instead of a floor polisher, it's a baby carriage rolling down the steps. Otherwise, the staging is identical. This same scene would be recreated on the steps of Union Station in Chicago for 1987's The Untouchables, and then again in 1994's Naked Gun 33 1/3, The Final Insult. Sam and Tuttle's crew have made it out of the ministry and down the massive front steps. A searchlight is scanning over the steps. Sam and Harry tuck in behind a pillar under a Mellowfields poster. Harry is taking off his backpack. The weird, deep-freeze-looking police vehicles head off down the street, sirens wailing. Harry produces an almost cartoon-like plunger detonator from his backpack. It looks exactly like what Wile E. Coyote might have purchased from Acme to blow up the Roadrunner. The noise of the battle, the pursuit, and the soundtrack all combine to be so loud, Harry doesn't say a word. He gestures to Sam, who knows exactly what to do. Sam puts both hands on the wooden handles of the plunger and pushes it down with his satisfied look. Cut to the exterior of the information retrieval building. Tuttle's crew had that place wired. Smoke, brick, and flame erupt over the entire face of the huge building. If you can, take a moment to slow these shots down. Freeze on the explosions. This is a miniature. Well, if you'd call something 20 feet tall a miniature. Two 20-foot-high models of the information retrieval building were created. This gave the effects crew two chances to get this shot. Gilliam says he's glad he had both tries. The first one was a disaster. Part of one whole section didn't blow. As you can see, the second pass was outstanding. Gilliam said he goes into these kinds of practical effects shots with multiple cameras rolling, all overcranked so he can slow the footage down later and make it feel bigger. The scenes of battle in the lobby, and especially the clips of blowing up the ministry, have all been shortened for the 132-minute edit. Gilliam claims the cataclysm and catharsis of an explosion was just what the story needed. In this world crushed under the weight of paperwork and bureaucracy, it was joyous to see the paper billowing down in the red light. Sam and Tuttle enjoy the spectacle for a few seconds, but then it's time to move on. Sam and Harry make it to the Level 47 shopping mall where Sam was with Jill earlier. Stormtroopers are patrolling. Harry has his pistol out and his hood pulled up over his face. Papers are swirling throughout the area, remnants of the recent ministry explosion. Harry gives Sam a nod, and Sam heads off into the crowd. Harry stops at one of the Keep Our City Tidy red trash chutes. Quick aside, don't those things look like the trash chutes the Who's used in the 2000 live-action version of The Grinch? Chutes like those were all over Whoville, and they emptied directly to Mount Crumpet. Harry is taking off his terrorist-looking stormtrooper garb and throwing it into the trash chute. Papers are swirling more aggressively around Harry as he changes his clothes. Sam is moving quickly but looks back to check on Harry's progress. Harry has changed out of his terrorist garb, but a paper has him by the ankle. More papers blow onto his face. Then they cover his body. Harry, the man who hates paperwork, is being attacked by some very aggressive paper. Sam runs back and kneels down by the mess of papers containing Harry. But hold on, Harry's gone. Sam is still kneeling next to where Harry had been when he realizes he's being watched by the other shoppers. Stormtroopers break things up and Sam runs for it. When Harry is attacked by the paperwork, we get a few more cuts for time. By the time Sam has clawed through the paperwork and is surrounded by onlookers, the 132-minute edit has now made it. It is a full 10 minutes shorter. There will be a couple of minor edits shortening things up during the chase scene, but we're essentially here. The U.S. edit is now down to 2 hours and 12 minutes. Sam is running through the streets when he comes to a courtyard. This is one of the best shots we get of the unique architecture of the curved Palazzo de Abraxas apartment complex. Sam runs right into the center structure, which seems to be a place of worship. 2 purple crosses are visible on opening doors. The doors reveal a space shaped somewhat like the torture chamber. Sam has stumbled into a church, or possibly a funeral home. Black fabric is covering the spots where mourners would be. As soon as Sam enters, Spiro, the maitre d' from Ida's restaurant, leans into the shot.
Oh, Mr. Lowry, so pleased. You can make it.
Spiro waves him up the aisle.
It's a sad loss. Your mother was with her at the end.
When we reach the spinning Pepto-Bismol pink casket with a huge bow on top, it becomes apparent this is a funeral for Alma Terrain. Her complications finally got the best of her.
My complication had a little complication.
A vicar, being played by British actor Roger Ashton Griffiths, is welcoming Alma to a place where her spirit will never grow old.
She came to us physically new. She goes hence from us not so physically new.
We see Shirley, Alma's daughter, turned out in her best black mourning hat. Sam hears a familiar trilling laugh off to his left. A red-headed woman is seated with her back to Sam. She's the center of attention for several admiring men. When the woman who we think is Ida finally turns, it's actually Jill Clayton wearing a red wig and a black upside-down shoe hat. The black shoe hat, perfect for looking stylish while in mourning. Sam is confused. This woman looks like Jill, but sounds like Ida. She also dresses like Ida.
Mother!
Stop calling me that!
It is definitely Ida's voice coming out of Jill's mouth. Sam has hit the jackpot when it comes to Oedipal fantasies. This twist is really messing with his head.
Mother! Mother, please!
One of the admirers asks if this guy is bothering her. Ida doesn't want anything distracting her suitors.
Go away. This is a very sacred moment.
As Sam is wrestling with the image of his mother looking all the world like his girlfriend, stormtroopers enter from all sides. They even rip through the enormous picture of Alma. Spiro opens the door for the stormtroopers entering at the other end of the room and even points to Sam. As Sam is starting to panic and moving behind the casket to protect himself, Ida turns again. This time, she's back to being Catherine Helmand in the same black shoe hat and black dress. Seeing her change from looking like Jill causes Sam to slip and knock the casket off the pedestal. What happens next is one of those scenes you can never erase from your brain once you've seen it. It's the first thing I see in my mind's eye anytime I think of this movie. The casket tilts, the foot falling first. It tips upright, and the contents slide out. The body of Alma Terrain is nothing but loose raw meat, gelatin, and a few bones. No, this isn't really happening. It's only Sam's fantasy, but this is exactly what you figured Chapman's acid procedures were doing to Alma. Wow, is this ever an indelible visual representation? A gooey and disgusting mess sluices out of the foot of the casket as Sam is kneeling beside it. The stormtroopers are closing in. Sam decides to jump into the newly vacated casket. Yeah, we are way into Sam's delusion now. He falls through a black void to land somewhere on a hybrid of the city streets and his own delusions. The towers from his dreams are blocking off his means of escape. The trolls, the prisoners, huge piles of ductwork, they're all conspiring to trap Sam. He climbs a mountain of ductwork, but he's stopped by a brick wall. Just as the prisoners in sackcloth are about to grab him, Sam finds a door handle in the brick. He turns it, and a door made of brick opens up right there in the wall. Without a second thought, Sam dives through the opening and slams the door behind him. He doesn't know where he's going, but it has to be better than here. The prisoners are pushing up against the door. Sam's fighting with them, trying to hold it closed. As Sam is still battling with the door, he has a look at his new surroundings. He's in a bedroom with bare walls, a couple of windows, and an unmade bed with bedclothes sitting on it. The whole room is in motion. Sam unsteadily runs to the back window. When he pulls up the blind, he can see a city street retreating behind him. This isn't one of the prison vehicles. Where is he? Sam peers through the blind at the other end of the room. Here he can see Jill through the back window of the Scammel. She's piloting them through the crowded city streets. Sam is on the trailer in the little house Jill was hauling. Or at least it's another little house. The first one was pretty damaged by the fire. Jill, in his saucy beret, looks over her shoulder and gives Sam a wink. Everything's gonna be okay. Sam has really tied a lot of his salvation to this truck. The Scammel has become Sam's chariot. Sam relaxes a bit and leans his head against the wall. Maybe this is gonna work out after all. Cut to an exterior of the big rig headed down the billboard-lined highway. Another cut, and we see Sam is now in the cab, snuggling up next to Jill. He looks out the window to see a change in landscape. The billboards are gone. A valley is opening out before him. It looks to be lush and green. A gorgeous orchestral rendition of Brazil can be heard. We then cut to a long shot of the valley. The Scammel can be seen parked. The trailer has been disconnected and the house is now occupied. Smoke is curling up from the chimney. It's an idyllic scene of domestic bliss. A cow is grazing. Green trees are creating a backdrop. How could things get any better? This is where Sid ended it. The Sid Sheinberg 96-minute Love Conquers All edit used this scene as reality. He rolled credits right here with Sam and Jill living out their lives in a tiny house in the country. Movie patrons then walk out of the theater smiling arm in arm, happy for the two lovebirds. At least that's how Sid saw it. This, of course, was not Gilliam's vision at all. In his version, the camera starts to do a slow zoom out. There is a cross dissolve and the pastoral scene changes. It has become a painting. The truck and the little house are gone. This is a painting Sam is imagining on the wall of the interrogation room. Sam is looking at it as he is blocking out whatever lint is doing to him. He's put himself in the painting with Jill, living there happily ever after. Helpman and Lint both lean into the frame. We are looking at them from Sam's point of view. Both look concerned. Cut, and the painting disappears. Both men are now in front of the huge wall of the cooling tower.
He's got away from us, Jack.
Afraid you're right, Mr. Helpman.
He's gone.
Refiners, you have to admit, the break room is a walk in the park compared to this place. The creepy baby mask is laying on the tray in the midst of the instruments of interrogation. These two men look so concerned, as though they weren't the ones who just pushed Sam to the point of mental breakdown. Jack pushes Helpman's wheelchair as they both leave the platform. The camera slowly pans around to reveal a staring Sam, now catatonic after his interrogation. He is completely withdrawn into his own fantasies. His brain is broken, but he doesn't care. He's living his dream life with Jill and her giant truck somewhere out in the country. Gilliam claims he viewed this as a happy ending. Sure, it's dark and twisted. Sam went insane from the questioning, but Gilliam sees it as Sam beating the system. He is able to find happiness even in the midst of the worst possible conditions. Although it's kind of bleak, Gilliam counts this as a win for Sam. After holding on Sam's face for several seconds, we cut to a long shot from the walkway. Helpman and Jack can still be seen leaving the room. The closing theme begins. In the 142-minute version, as the final music begins and we see credits, the shot stays on Sam in the interrogation chair with the cooling tower walls visible in the background. Oh, and as I'm watching the credits, it occurs to me I didn't mention it was Catherine Pogson who played Alma's daughter, Shirley. In the shorter edit, we get an effect where the interrogation chair platform becomes isolated. The rest of the room falls away to reveal clouds. Sam is sitting on the round platform out in the middle of billowy white clouds. Credits begin, accompanied by a jazzy version of Brazil. The platform eventually disappears, and we are adjusting clouds through the rest of the closing credits of the 132-minute version. In the longer edit, it's nothing but the walls of the cooling tower throughout the credits. And there you have it, refiners. A look at Brazil, one of the inspirations for Dan Erickson as he went about creating Severance. If you're interested, there is a book and a documentary about the making of Brazil. I've glossed over many of the finer details when it comes to making of stories. Getting this thing made and eventually released was such a long and involved process, I had to skip a lot of it. Where you'd normally expect a book or documentary to cover a director taking a look at all of their work, this is rarely the case with Gilliam. This isn't the only time a single Gilliam movie has spawned either a book or a doc about the production. His projects are usually epic, troubled, and filled with crazy stories. Thanks for joining me, refiners, and congratulations. This file is now at 100%. Feel free to shut down your workstation. It's time to head home for the day. Keep an eye on this space, refiners. The Origins episodes of the podcast are quickly becoming more popular than the regular series episodes. I have a few ideas, and I've been sent a few suggestions for future Origins episodes. I'm going to take some time off here at the end of the summer, but I'll be back with more of these Origins stories in a few weeks. At present, there's no good news anywhere about either the WGA or SAG-AFTRA strikes. Hang in there, refiners, and keep thinking those positive thoughts. I have faith that someday our precious Severance will return for a second season. Hopefully it's before our favorite refiners have aged too much. For now, you need to put down that finger trap and get back to your Audi lives. Exit via the elevator and remember to please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate Severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.